Hi, my name is Ben Armstrong.
Hi, this is David Koch.
My name is Thomas Maurer.
Hi, I'm Donna Sarkar.
Hi, my name is Lana Montgomery.
Hi, I'm Seth Warres.
Hi, I'm Aaron Thomas.
I'm Jess Dodson.
Hi, I'm Rocky Heckman.
Hi, I'm Sonia Cuff.
Hi, I'm Troy Hunt.
Hello, this is Wally Mead.
My name is Reid Purvis.
Hi, I'm Lars Flynn.
Hi, my name is Alan Birchall.
Hi, I'm Adam Fowler.
Hi, I'm Sky Guthrie, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
All the latest Microsoft Cloud news, as well as industry guest deep dive conversations. It's a Need to Know podcast. All thanks to the CIA Ops patron community. The Need to Know podcast. Catch us on Twitter and Facebook, N2K Podcast, and online at ciaops.podbean.com.
Welcome along to a Need to Know podcast. This is episode 271, and my name is Robert Crane. Thank you very much for joining me again for this episode. Hope everybody is staying safe and well out there. And here is the latest news from the Microsoft Cloud. So Microsoft had its big partner event recently, Inspire. You can go and have a look at many of the recordings that are now available on demand. So again, inspire.microsoft.com. You don't need to be a partner to do this. And again, you can go and look through all these videos and look at the sessions. Now, probably the biggest announcement from the event was Windows 365. This is, I suppose, a repurposing of Windows Virtual Desktop. It's a aim to bring the ability to log into a Windows PC basically through a browser or through a desktop app. So think of it like remote desktop services in the cloud hosted by Microsoft, where they're taking a lot of the infrastructure worries away from you, providing a simpler approach to this. Now, in essence, there are two versions of this. There is a business and an enterprise version. The business version can connect to Azure AD directly, has a nice, simple Windows interface, just a subscription per month. Now, this went live on the 2nd of August. Now, also, there is an enterprise version. So the enterprise version is much more like the traditional Windows Virtual Desktop technology. It gives you more flexibility, but at this point in time still retains the requirement for a traditional Windows Active Directory. So the aim for Microsoft is to obviously look at eliminating this over time. We know that the ability to do Azure AD join directly is now in preview, but we haven't seen it roll into Windows Virtual Desktop in totality yet. So we're waiting for that to happen so that we can do an Azure AD join with the enterprise version without the need for a traditional domain controller. However, in SMB, the story is a little bit different, that it's all delivered through a simple web interface. You buy a license for the sort of machine or the power of the machine that you're after, and it will provision it through a website, and then you can access it also through a website. Now, Microsoft was offering a 2-month trial with this service when it first announced it, but they've been swamped with demand, so the trials have been put on hold. You can go on to a waiting list for these, but the service is available commercially, but the trial, you would have to go on to a waiting list. So what I've put in the show notes is a couple of links to give you more information about the product. So again, it's called Windows 365. There is a business and enterprise version. I focused here on the business version. And there is a good YouTube video that runs you through the setup and the configuration. Now, I think this is going to be a pretty big product for Microsoft because it's sort of the next evolution in a world at the moment where we have restrictions around obtaining PCs. So obtaining physical PCs, chips and so on has proved to be very, very challenging. Being able to deploy this from a Microsoft data center using nothing but a few clicks on a website, I think is a pretty powerful proposition. Also for many businesses who are now doing remote work and with users working from different locations on different devices, I think this does make a lot of sense. Still early days on in this release. We expect it to continue to improve over time, but my advice to you would be is to go in and have a look, have a play around. It's not obviously a few dollars a month. It is an expensive, I suppose, way to get a PC. But I would suggest, like I said, to go in, sign up, play with it for at least a month, get an idea what it's all about. The business version, like I said, is very, very simple, very, very straightforward to set up and get going. The enterprise version, although it does give you more flexibility, is a little bit more complex to configure. But I'll leave you to go and have a look at that. Have a look at the links that I have included in the show notes for you. Now, some more changes coming to OneNote. Now, for those of you who remember, we had a OneNote desktop, which we've had for many, many years, that came with Office. Microsoft then started to move towards a Windows 10 app delivered from the Microsoft Store. There was a lot of pushback from that because it didn't contain all the functionality. A lot of people preferred what was available in the traditional version that came with Office. So Microsoft has now sort of announced that it looks as though it's going to go back to the desktop app in the longer run. It's going to maintain and standardize the two different versions that are available, the desktop app as well as the Windows Store app. But there is a blog post here that will give you some more details. But at the end of the day, if you read between the lines here, it says it looks as though it's going to focus on the original Office application and then bring all the functionality and features from the Windows 10 into that. And the long-term aim looks as though that the Windows 10 app will be deprecated, but you never know what can happen. We've had these sort of machinations with OneNote before. So again, if you are a OneNote user like I am, go in, have a look at that. Make sure that you understand the changes and what's going on with the product. Now, of course, there's lots and lots of new stuff with Microsoft Teams. There's a link I've put in the show notes for you to go and have a look at that. Keep up to date with everything that's happening. What I was really excited about was a Q&A app that's going to really help me manage events, live events. So one of the big challenges with big events is that you get a lot of chat, a lot of people, I suppose, shooting the breeze in the background, which is very distracting. So a Q&A app is on its way to us shortly in Teams, but you'll see here that we've got the ability to do recording automatic recordings. We've also got our real-time translations available for us. We've got more capabilities in calling and on mobile and with more devices also available. So again, go in, have a look at that link, see what's happening in the world of Teams. Now, if we have a look at security, Microsoft's got two really good articles here about coin miners and these threats called Lemon Duck and Lemon Cat. Who knows where they get those names from, but makes very interesting reading. Two very comprehensive blog posts, lots of information about how these compromises take place, what the actual train is when an attacker does manage to gain access, and to help you defend against that. So I'd encourage you to go in and read those in depth, get a better feel and a better idea and understanding of how these attacks happen, what they target, and then how they're carried out. Because again, defense is really going to be something to understand when it comes to these attacks, which are becoming more and more sophisticated every single day. Now, Microsoft is continuing to ride the revenue wave of the current pandemic. Their figures are once again up quite significantly, along with every other tech giant in the space. So I'll put a link to the revenue so you can go in and have a look at that. But again, things like Teams, Azure, Office 365, Microsoft 365 are driving this trend, especially with the work from home requirements and the desire to have access to a lot of these capabilities. Things like AI and so on are also driving the need for more computing power provided directly from the cloud. Now, one of the other things that I saw recently is something called app governance. Now, app governance is something we can add to our device environment to help us monitor, manage, and get signals, better signals from our applications and our devices. This will then feed through into things like Microsoft Cloud App Security and Sentinel, which is a great thing. It is currently in public preview. I haven't seen it drop here in Australia. I believe it's available in other regions of the world. So if you are in those regions, go in, have a look, and see what sort of additional information can be provided by this capability to give you better in-depth understanding and monitoring of your devices. Now, probably the other big announcement from Inspire for partners was the fact that Microsoft Lighthouse is now in public preview. So public preview is going to be available typically to CSP partners. There's no cost to set up Lighthouse for your environments. You can just go into the store and buy that for $0. And in essence, what Lighthouse will allow you to do is multi-tenant management. So if you're a partner that needs to manage on behalf of a number of customers, you can create this connection so that you can have visibility into your customers' tenants without having to physically log into that with a different ID. So you can use what's known as delegated admin to gain access to partner tenants and perform maintenance. Now, much of Lighthouse is still in the early days. It does some very basic stuff like looking at AV and policies and things like that, but it still has a way to go, and remember that it is in public preview. But if you are a partner, make sure you go in and sign up to that, have a look at it, have a play with it, and beware of the limitations of it or the prerequisites. The other major prerequisite for Lighthouse is that you will need at least one Microsoft 365 Business Premium SKU in the tenant to make this capability light up. Now remember that Lighthouse, Microsoft 365 Lighthouse, now joins Azure Lighthouse in its ability to do multi-tenant access. So we need a separate Microsoft 365 Lighthouse and a separate Azure Lighthouse to maintain the ability to do multi-tenant admin of clients. So there are two Lighthouse products. Azure Lighthouse has been around for a little while now, and Microsoft 365 Lighthouse has now gone into public preview. I'll put the link in the show notes for you to go and have a look at. Now, with that, why don't we get into our interview? But if you do want to contact me, provide any feedback or thoughts, please do so on the Twitters at DirectorCIA. You can send me an email directly, director@ciaops.com. I thank you very much for taking the time to listen to this episode, and I really hope that you enjoy the interview. Welcome along to our interview for this episode. I'm joined by an old friend, Linus Cheng. Welcome along.
Oh, thanks for having me, Robert. Pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Well, before we dive into what we'd like to talk about and cover today, I thought I would get Linus to give us a bit of background on himself, because he has been a well-known entity for many years across the industry, maybe gone into the shadows a little bit of late. So, Linus, why don't you give us a bit of your background and what you are currently up to?
Oh, thanks, Robert. So my background is really as a computer programmer. I've been programming computers since I was 8 years old on the old Apple IIc, and I still get a lot of fond memories reminiscing about those days. And after university, I quit my job, I think after about 2 years working in industry, and then said, right, my passion is writing software. So happened to stumble across the opportunity for writing backup software for the small, medium business market.
Sorry, what year? What sort of year was that?
Oh, that was 2001, 2002.
Cool, yep.
Yeah, and figured out a way to get the scheduling of Windows Backup to work well, then released a product called Backup Assist, and it really blew up. I mean, it grew exponentially, and we've made thousands and hundreds of thousands of sales to 165 countries.
Now, would you say that grew on the back of Small Business Server, or was it all sorts of Windows servers? Do you think the Small Business Server, which was about that time, really was the breakout product? Did that sort of make it for you?
Yeah, absolutely it did. I think we started growing big around 2005 and then accelerated with SBS 2008 as well. So I think there was an 03 version, an 08 version. Yep. And that's absolutely coincided with the explosion of servers in the small business.
Excellent. All right. So since that's obviously gone a bit on the wayside now, how is your progression from, you know, the move to the cloud? What sort of happened in that time period?
Yeah, so we probably hit our peak sales around about 5 years ago. And since then, with more and more people moving to the cloud, the market for on-premise backup, and in fact, market for everything on-premise, has been declining. So since then, we've developed a backup product for Office 365 as well, and that's now the primary focus and what keeps me working 27 hours a day. we've just noticed that our clients have been probably the middle to late adopters moving to the cloud. But you know, it's great that we're still able to serve them after all these years.
Well, I think it's an interesting, it's an interesting journey you've had, because again, you're a smaller provider in the software space, obviously, based out here in Australia, but selling to the world. You've started off, in the on-prem environment, and now the transition for you as a vendor has moved from the on-prem world to the cloud. So just as a matter of idea here, or perspectives, is how much of the business is still the on-prem version of your software versus the cloud these days? Is it still a 10% market, or what sort of percentage do you think is still, the on-prem side of things?
Great question. Actually, the majority of our sales are still on-prem. We've managed to find ourselves a very nice niche in the marketplace. And, I can think of things like medical practice software. So we do partner with these sorts of providers, and as part of an on-prem solution that gets delivered out to clients, our software will be on every install. So we found a nice niche. There are also niches where clients simply cannot connect to the internet. US government, departments and laboratories that I can't, for privacy reasons, can't mention. But those types of clients have very specific needs. And we're very fortunate that, in addition to serving the wider market, a lot of people do have these requirements, and we're an ideal fit for them.
Okay, so here's another question that I've always pondered about from a vendor's side of the fence when you're looking at a product. Now, back in the on-prem days, you would have typically sold your product outright. So you would have, one single purchase price, you get version 5. If you want version 6, yes, perhaps there was an upgrade when that was available. But now, in the world of the cloud, it's all about the subscription model. So much per month for these features. Now, do you have you transitioned your costing model to all one subscription model, or do you have both? How do you approach pricing in a world where the cloud is one model subscription, where on-prem traditionally was a outright purchase?
That is such a good question, because we're in analyzing our client base, we also thought that everyone would want to transition to subscription, and we put a lot of time, money, and effort into developing subscription offerings. And we've recently received quite a lot of feedback going in the opposite direction. And that was a surprise to us. And then we Googled subscription fatigue, and that's actually a thing. So
yeah, I think I think another way is the death by a thousand cuts. I think that now everything is a subscription. Your mobile apps, your backup, your milk, just about everything is via subscription. And when you look at your credit card statement, you've got all these subscriptions, and they can be hard to track, but also, it's a lot of accounting pain to do that rather than a once-off purchase. So I would see that, again, I can certainly appreciate that may be the case for many.
Yeah. So our solution is to offer both. Really, our job is to deliver the product and service that our clients want. And if one part of the market wants subscription and the other part wants perpetual, we bend over backwards to support both. I think that for a vendor to dictate things to a client is hard, because we are a smaller vendor, a boutique niche vendor, and for us to move the industry is not really possible. We can't be like Microsoft or Google and say, this is how you shall order, this is how you shall do business. So our job is to do the exact opposite, find what people want to do and then make it easy.
All right. So another interesting concept that I've, again, struggled with or trying to help understand is that
Back in the day, there was a large community of resellers around the SBS product, which is where we initially met. Mm. And a lot of those people, that community is now largely very different from what it was before. So a lot of those people have, you know, moved on, retired, or given it away. You've also got a new brand or a new group of people who've come into the market, you know, born in the cloud, as they like to call themselves. That brings a different mindset. So from your point of view, what was the transition like to get your product out to people who are coming from a place where you hadn't, you know, initially had them in your community? You know, there's people coming from outside the community, cloud first people, focused on Microsoft 365, for example, rather than on-prem. How have you, you know, improved, or how have you used your marketing to reach that sort of new audience that is coming on board?
I think one of the things about us is that we've always been a little bit different in our approach. A lot of our lead acquisition actually comes from meeting specific technical requirements. So we don't necessarily have a fantastic view of everything that a client is trying to achieve. We see that they're trying to achieve a certain task, you know, in terms of backup. They want to do it a certain way, and then we offer a solution to meet that need. So in terms of, I know your perception of who our client base was, SBS users absolutely in the small medium business community was a big proportion. But we also had a lot of resellers and MSPs out there who picked us for specific technical reasons. And what we've been able to do, Robert, is build a good relationship with them and retain them for many, many years, probably longer than we would have ever expected. So they still form the base of our clients today. Now, in terms of acquiring new customers, the backup market is incredibly commoditized, and there's basically a product to do anything that you want. In terms of how you want to store the data, where you want it to store it to. So there's just an amazing freedom of choice. The way we focus on it, we know that every product is basically can do roughly the same sort of thing. So it's really about building that relationship with the client and making sure that we're easy to do business with. If they want subscription, if they want perpetual, we can offer that. And that's one side of it is making the business relationship easy. And of course, the other is looking at the real reason why people are backing up nowadays. And of course, that's the cyber aspect and having very targeted features against ransomware attack and both detection and shielding capabilities for the backups. So I guess that's how the landscape has shifted over these years.
All right. So you would probably agree that the majority of your client base is technical. They're largely resellers who, again, are using you over and over again based on the success of the product, which is, you know, a great thing. And that will continue, obviously, to grow as they also continue to you know, grow and grow their businesses. And as you indicated, there will always be a need for, you know, a backup independent of what the vendor is. And for many people, that's a regulatory requirement. I think that's fantastic. Now, just another perspective here. What would you say is your market share of, you know, the Australian market versus overseas? Is the majority of your business generated from overseas?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I would say over 95% of our market is overseas.
Okay, and now, sorry, is that typically US-based or is it, you know, across different areas?
Yeah, so US accounts for roughly 40% and Europe for maybe slightly more, and rest of the world is would be under 10%.
Okay, all right, so again, it's a nice spread across the full market, which obviously is going to benefit and sort of, you know, diversify, you know, the environment. Now, have you found any challenges with your product versus the different regions? So because, for example, European Union has the GDPR compliance, is there any adjustments or differences that you need to consider or incorporate in your package versus in the US versus here in Australia?
It's funny you mentioned that because the differences are huge. So in the German market, for example, it's all about data security and making sure that we encrypt. Whereas a feature like encryption in the US is very, very rarely used. So I can say tapping into these markets presents the opportunity. We also find that there's a different rate of cloud adoption. For example, the UK has really ramped up their cloud adoption in the last 18 months, whereas Germany is still behind there. And they do prefer to have servers under their control on-premise and therefore data under their control as well.
Okay, so again, that would make a very challenging environment, obviously, because you've got a base level product, but then you've got these, you know, different markets, and it's sort of a unique perspective. And to me, again, one of the challenges is that, you know, you're selling a product into different markets, different regulations, and also on the other side, receiving payments from different regions in different currencies and balancing all that out and doing the books. So as you progressed your business from an Australian-focused business to a worldwide business, you know, what's that experience been like? Was that did you find that an easy transition? Did you find that it would be easier, you know, if you'd known something earlier on? What was the experience of moving to an international business, both selling and, you know, taking payments?
Yeah. So from a product development point of view, which is really my background as a programmer, it really doesn't matter where our customers are. So we just get the laundry list of feature requests and requirements, and we develop against that. The real challenge is knowing that we can't please everyone at the same time. So then being very rigorous in triage and prioritizing what we do. The main difference or the main challenge we have as an Australian company actually is on the sales and marketing side, which I think you were alluding to there, because practically every single trade show that we did was overseas. So when we went to CeBIT in Germany, that was a $40,000 exercise by the time you package up airfares and accommodation. But whenever we went to the US, it was pretty much the same story. So we had to be very, savvy and targeted with the amount of money spent. And often we would have to spend money on these shows and we wouldn't get a return for 1 to 2 years. But the return that we eventually got from doing those shows was so big, it was kind of a no-brainer. We just have to be patient.
All right. So again, maybe before we transition to another topic, in the backup product, which you have obviously invested a lot of your time and you developed over a long period of time, you know, looking at it at this point in time moving forward, do you see the same opportunities, growth, development, you know, excitement about doing that backup product? Or do you feel that it's got to a level where it's, you know, it's adequate enough, it's good enough, there's not going to be a lot more innovation or development in it? What's your feeling on, you know, where can the product go in general from here?
Yeah, my gut feel is the latter, because I think the technology is very well established. And really the big thing to come out in the last few years has, of course, been protections against the cyber threats and specifically malware and ransomware. So for us, that was the major innovation from about 2018 was putting in those features. Now, is there much more to go? I mean, when you look at the evolution of Windows Server, sure, they've introduced REFS, there's tweaks all over the place, but they're not, I would say, revolutionary. And given Microsoft's roadmap to focus everything in the cloud, we don't really expect that there's going to be a heap of action in that space. I could stand corrected, of course. I mean, ransomware came out of nowhere, and I guess breathed new life into the absolute need for having good backups. But when you look at the market in terms of backups and business continuity, I kind of think that it's pretty well handled. So really, I see the big, I guess, unanswered questions is how do people meet the regulatory requirements that they have that they would normally have done using backup software? So I'll give you an example. We've got a client that I just heard from who needs to retain data for 117 years. Now, how that comes about, I don't know, but given that the oldest person is roughly 117 years, I guess it's retaining data for the lifetime of their clients. Now, I don't know about you, Robert, but I can't predict what's going to happen in 117 years. And with people storing data in the cloud, is the cloud provider going to be there? How do you migrate data in and out? I don't know the answers to these questions yet. But to me, that kind of seems to be the opportunity, I guess. If we can solve problems like those, then I think we'd be doing well.
It's interesting because one of the things I did come across recently was, and it has happened to me before, but not wasn't a showstopper. But, you know, someone needed to recover something from a backup, but the problem was the backup was on a zip, the old zip drives, purpley things. And it's like, oh, crap, I've got the drive, but I've got the disk, but where's the drive? So then they had to go and find somebody in the bottom of the garage that's got a zip drive and hope and pray. And it's like, I think we underestimate that, yes, we've got a backup, but the media, so we started off, with floppies and zip drives and tape drives and so on. And it turns out that if you do need something that old, you've really got to consider the media. And that probably means migrating a lot of the stuff, into more modern media. So if you've got, old tape backups that are on a Sony drive that may not be available anymore, that could be a problem. Whereas, again, maybe you need to keep moving these backups forward. So some unique challenges there, I think. And again, I don't think it's going to go away. I don't think we know what technology is going to provide or the requirements and the regulations. So I think it's always going to be there. And I think that anybody who says that any technology will, die overnight or will not be needed in the future, I don't think is generally going to be proven wrong simply because, the technology is going to be required and it's become such a basis for everything that we do these days. So anyway, something interesting to think about, but I'd like to pivot on that to something else that I think the listeners would really enjoy. Now, one of the things I most admire about you was the amount of investment you made in your own personal development. So you've come from a traditional background, you've done the university thing, you've gone out into the real world and worked for the man for a short period of time before you've decided that you're better off working for yourself, but you've continued with this investment in your own personal development. So why has that been important to you over all this period of time?
Well, I think I distinctly remember after I quit my job, I remember walking to the supermarket to get some food. And then I realized, gee, this money that I'm spending, how am I going to get someone to pay me money after I started the business? And it just hit me like a ton of bricks, that previous success that I had in past fields, which was mainly computer programming and doing that at university as well. Previous success basically counts for nothing when you go into business. It is such a great leveler that there are so many different skills you need, like sales and marketing and product development, customer service. There are so many skills that you need. It's almost like starting from scratch again. So it hit me like an absolute ton of bricks. And from that moment, I just gathered books, books on marketing, books on advertising. I followed quite a number of business leaders, business coaches as well, and just immersed myself in that. I believe that no matter what level you are at, there's always room to improve, always room to gain another skill. And certainly in my journey, I've been witness to people like yourself, Robert. You know, you're extremely proficient at presenting in front of a crowd, educating people. You know, that's something that I admire and that I would want to get better at myself. And I think really being in business, you have to be a generalist. There comes a time where you can't know everything about a particular topic in the same way that you used to. And for me, I've had to hand over, I guess, the keys to the programming and let my development team do that while I've focused on other areas of the business that required attention.
Okay. Well, yeah, thank you very much for those kudos. So in your evaluation and the time period and the investments that you've made, what would you call out as being, you know, if you were to give advice to someone who would come to you and say, look, you know, what should I learn first? What should I invest in first? You know, which book should I buy? What do you feel has made the biggest impact for you? It doesn't have to be a cost thing, but what would you recommend to people that you got a lot of benefit out of yourself that made a lot of difference for you and was worthwhile the investment that you made? Because as we know, not all topics, not all speakers, not all books, not all courses are of the same value. And it's always good to know a feedback from people to say, look, yeah, you know, this book is a must have. It looks very simple. And, one of the classic ones is, you know, Who Moved My Cheese, which is a very simple, short book, but can have a very impactful meaning for people. So for you, what were those ones?
Without a doubt, 100%. The difference between success and failure for us was Google Ads, Google AdWords, as they were known back in the day, and being able to write marketing copy. So for me, that was direct response advertising. So I was an absolute student of people like Claude Hopkins and John Caples, who put out books on how to write and persuade a reader to your point of view. And that was absolutely crucial because at the time, Google Ads, when we ran out the Google Ads in about 2003, 2004, we were able to get 5 cent clicks to the website. And then once a person hits the website, I wrote a tailored sales letter that would get somewhere between 20 to 40% conversion to a download. So without those skills, none of anything else would have been possible. And obviously, Robert, the days of 5 cent clicks on Google Ads are well and truly gone. But I think the principles of direct response advertising live on, despite obviously the proliferation of social media and Instagram and the different ways people are influencing each other. I'm still a big believer in being able to write compelling sales copy.
Okay. All right. So again, obviously getting your message across in a way that, gets the value statement across to the reader or the viewer as quickly as possible. That is definitely a skill side of it. What else would you say was a worthwhile investment? Now, this could be on the organizational side or the, you know, any of the other skills that you find out there.
Yeah, definitely in the early days, it's all about communication and sales. It's funny I say that because the success in the early days of business is entirely dependent on cash flow. And, I should preface that. Back in when I was starting the business, it was about cash flow and making sales so that you can then fund the next bit of R&D and improve the product. Nowadays, it probably is a bit different because people would look at raising money first. But certainly back in those days, it was about cash flow. So the other skills are very tightly linked. For me, public speaking was a big thing. Being able to get on stage in front of 100 or 200 MSPs and present a topic that, let's face it, technical topics can be very dry and boring. And the question I have is, how can I deliver a topic that's persuasive, that they know me as a personality, not just as a technical person, and have enough interest to try the product. And that's extremely difficult to do because most of us are very logical in our thinking. So how do you crack a few jokes on stage and amuse the audience? How can you present new information to the audience in a way that they're wowed by that? And there were certainly, I guess, people I followed like Jeff Middleton who were able to do that on stage and be larger than life. So I found that is a very important skill. And I hope I've got, you know, if I'm a quarter as good as Jeff, I'd be very happy.
I think, again, there is, you're right. I mean, that really does build the cult, if you want to call it. It gets you that recognition. It's what social media is largely all about today. It's being able to have that standout presence and also get the information across, but also be able for people to, you know, approach you, ask you questions. I think, again, as mentioned, Jeff was someone who did that really, really well. But the core of it is you've got to know your stuff. You know, you can't get up on stage and you know, carry on like that to an audience who is technical. They'll basically see straight to you. So you've got to have that technical background. And I think the biggest challenge for a lot of IT people coming from their background is that they're not really people because, that they've not been brought up like that. They were, yeah, here's a problem, go away, fix it, you know, tell us when it's done sort of thing, rather than being, you know, front and center. So that obviously was a, you know, a big change and something that, you know, you seem to have, you know, come across, and you've continued the growth and also growing out your business. So how many people in your business now? How many people do you employ?
Oh, I lose count. I think it's roughly about 25.
So again, I mean, that's starting from basically yourself, isn't it, all the way up to the size of the business today?
Yeah, that's right. We've been entirely funded by cash flow, so we've never had any capital injections, and I guess we're quite proud of that, because when you take other people's money, it's very easy to waste it, but you're very careful when it's your own money, of course.
Of course. Now, again, the last pivot we have before probably we look at the rounding it up, the time that we have, if you were to look at the world today from your point of view, I think that as a programmer and someone who's developed a business and you know, is in the market today and is familiar with cloud and on-prem, you know, looking forward into the future here, would it be fair to say that, you know, the world is going to be much more about software than it is about hardware? It's going to be about being able to do some form of coding, even if you are a traditional hands-on person. You need to be looking at these software options because that's where the opportunities are. Is that sort of the way you feel the market's going?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's great that now in schools, coding is taught from such an early age. And it's one of those skills. It's kind of like money management. You know, it's a skill that everyone who has that skill is going to thrive. So 100% software is where it's at.
And now, it's interesting. Sorry to interrupt. It's interesting to note that neither do they teach software at school, and neither do they teach money management at school either. So it's like if you can develop this skill, you're going to be far ahead of everybody else who hasn't learnt this on their own. So sorry to interrupt, but yeah, I just find that amazing in this day and age.
Yeah, and I think the other skill is communication. With really good communication and building relationships with each other, I think that's highly important. And of course, communication is really about listening. I mean, how often do we hear people wanting to say things, but really you can tell the moment they open their mouth, they haven't actually listened. They haven't actually thought through critical thinking, thought through an issue before opening their mouth. So yeah, for me, it's all about ingesting information and then processing it. I'm a programmer after all, Robert.
Well, as they say, you've got two ears and one mouth, and it should be used in that ratio, which I think is a very, very wise saying when you sit down and look at it. So where do you see, you know, your future, the future of Backup Assist, maybe the future of the industry in total, if we can sort of, you know, give you get you to have a bit of a summary think about, you know, how do you see your personal progression moving forward? Where would you like to get to? Where would you like to see your business? And then in general, where do you see, you know, the market? Let's take the SMB market that we're all familiar with and generally a part of. Where do you see that heading into the future?
Fantastic question, Robert. I am probably the worst future gazer that you will meet. When I started the business, I thought, okay, maybe this is about 5 years before Microsoft takes over the backup market and integrates it into the operating system. And they never actually did that. So the fact that we're still here 20 years down the track is a complete unexpected occurrence for me. Now, how long will this last? To be honest, I don't know. I couldn't have predicted ransomware, for example. So there may well be something else that comes in the future that means that people will need to continue their backups in ways that we don't even know about. For example, now it's not just protecting your backup, it's protecting your backup from ransomware as well. And I suspect that the future is going to be a combination with a focus on cybersecurity. But, beyond that, I find it very difficult to tell. So what we're going to do, we're continuing to serve our clients in the best way possible. And I guess the future will take care of itself.
What about yourself? Where do you see yourself in, 5 years, 10 years? Where do you see your future personally rolling out, and what things would you like to invest, in your own personal development, or do you think that will be important for people down the track that you may not have, invested in as yet?
Yeah, the area that amazes me the most is the progression in artificial intelligence and machine learning. Because I went to university in the late 90s, 96 to 98, and what we studied as theoretical concepts in artificial intelligence, nowadays anyone can pick up a book, teach themselves Python programming, and download a machine learning framework and have it running on the laptop in a few hours. Now, to me, that's staggering, the amount of potential there, and both good and bad potential for machine learning, I think is astounding. So, I'm teaching myself a bit, getting back into the programming on the code, and enjoying every moment of it.
Excellent. All right. Well, to round things off, Linus, do you have any links or any, recommendations or books that you certainly recommend people could go out and grab and have a look at or review or keep an eye on? And as well, if you can give us some information as to how people can keep up with what you're doing personally and professionally, as well as a way maybe to get in contact with you if they do have any further questions.
Yeah, so in terms of business entrepreneurship and particularly small business, I'm a big fan of Brad Sugars. And he's written, I think, around 9 or 10 different books that I would recommend wholeheartedly. My contact details, well, the website is www.backupassist.com. And what I'll do is I'll shoot through my email address to you, Robert. So if anyone wants to get in contact, they can.
Yep. Excellent. All right. Well, I, again, encourage people to take advantage of that. Look at what Linus provides, both for on-prem and in the cloud. Like I said, a good Aussie provider there, has been a provider now for many, many years. And again, I think you're providing fantastic service. And obviously, you've got a very loyal following of core customers, which I think is very, is a real achievement over the time period where everybody wants everything bright, new and shiny these days in technology. So again, I'll take this opportunity on behalf of the listeners to thank Linus for your time and for sharing all of that with our listeners. That's been fantastic. Thanks again, Linus.
Thank you for having me, Robert.
Excellent. Well, I also thank everybody else for listening to this episode of the Need to Know podcast.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Microsoft 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selections available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.